You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When 60 members of the Gambino family were rounded up recently, many saw it as a huge hit on organized crime in America. But actually, global organized crime is thriving here, and it's likely to have touched your life in one way or another, through cell phones, email fraud, or luxury goods. Former BBC World Correspondent Misha Glenny estimates that the shadow economy now makes up 20% of global GDP. He's called his latest book, McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld. It's published by Knopf, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Misha Glenny to the show today. Hello.
Thank you very much, Lena.
How many ways does global organized crime enter our lives in ways that we might not be aware of?
Well, I like to divide up global organized crime into consumer nations, producer nations, and transit nations, and we are very much consumer nations. The big market for illicit goods and services, whether it's narcotics, whether it's women trafficked into prostitution or illegal migrant labor, counterfeit cigarettes, counterfeit goods. That the biggest market is here in the United States, the European Union, Japan, and also, interestingly, the Middle East.
So has the old Sicilian immigrant mafia, La Cosa Nostra, that was such an important force in this country, just become a blip of the global shadow economy?
Yes, it's not very important, the Sicilian mafia. It suffered huge blows in the early 1990s, as did the five families here in New York. That's partly because law enforcement here in the United States against indigenous organized crime groups, particularly the RICO legislation, anti-racketeering legislation, has been very effective. But organized crime has evolved into a very different thing, moving right across the world now and cooperating in those nooks and crannies that globalization has opened up as trade flows, capital flows, and migration flows have increased astronomically over the past 15 years.
So when we talk about mafia today, we usually talk about Russian mafia. Well, spelt with a Y.
Yes. The Russian mafia were an extraordinary phenomenon. They basically grew up in the early 1990s. When communism collapsed in the former Soviet Union, it took with it the state as well. And so the police forces collapsed, the courts collapsed. And at the same time, Russia was switching from a planned economy to a free market economy. And in a free market economy, you basically have the contract at the center of law. A contract has to be honored. And if you don't have the police and you don't have the courts to do that, then the businessmen like to get their own protection, which we know as the mob, the mafia, or protection rackets. And they were ubiquitous in Russia in the 1990s, and they were the law. They defined what was legal, what was illegal, who was going to do what deal, and who would get what profit. They ran the place.
We had our robber barons. They had their robber barons with an emphasis on the word robber. But what happened when, when Vladimir Putin consolidated power? Didn't he get rid of some of these guys?
He did get rid of some of these guys, but essentially what he was doing, you're right to mention the robber barons. It's the same phenomenon as the robber barons, except there's one big difference, and that is the Russian robber barons, or oligarchs as we came to call them, had the mineral resources of Russia at their disposal, i.e. oil and gas, which is worth gazillions, essentially, and they pocketed that. Now, when Putin came along, what he did was to bring this back under the control of the Russian state, which is a powerful residual being, and it was waking up after its hibernation, discovered that the oligarchs had taken all of its honey. The Russian bear looked around very upset and decided it wanted the honey back. And the oligarchs could either stay in Russia and do a deal with Putin, or they went into exile, or if they threatened him politically, they were put in prison, like Mikhail Khodorkovsky.
So some made the deal, and some left, and some wound up in prison.
Exactly so. And you also had key figures who were more strictly organized crime characters who were brokering the deals of selling gas from Turkmenistan in Central Asia through Russia, through Ukraine, into Western Europe. And these figures, in the past 6 months or so, we've seen a number of arrests. It looks to me as though in Russia, gangster capitalism is coming to an end. It doesn't mean, however, that Russia is suddenly becoming fantastically democratic. It's not.
But wasn't Putin beholden to the Solntsevo Brotherhood?
Not to Solntsevo, no. Apart from it, I think Solntsevo is a Moscow-based group, and St. Petersburg is basically Putin's bailiwick. No, Putin's strength resides in the KGB. Now, the KGB in the 1990s was subordinate to groups like Solntsevo and the oligarchs, but the KGB has made a huge comeback as the key representative of the state under Putin, and Solntsevo is now subordinate to the KGB.
I remember speaking many years ago to somebody who had supported himself in the old Soviet Union by buying goods in Odessa and then bring them to his hometown. Odessa has actually blossomed since the fall of the Soviet Union.
Well, it blossomed to an extent. In the early 1990s, it was a very vigorous and interesting place. But in 1997, there was a murder in Odessa of the man who was the sort of capo, the big don of Odessa, called Karabas. And he had kept everything under control. Once he died, Odessa was the focus of a tremendous turf war between Moscow-based organized crime groups and Chechen organized crime groups because it was the city out of which Russian oil was exported. And so control of it was absolutely critical.
Where would the Chechens involved here have fit in the civil war or the independence war in Chechnya?
Ah, well, with the independence war in Chechnya, they had a relationship with the independence fighters, but it was basically commercially based. We mustn't confuse the Chechen gangsters with the Chechen independence insurgents, as it were. The Chechen gangsters' main base was not in Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. It was in Moscow. And they competed with the Slavic groups in Moscow for turf control, and they had branches all over Russia. And the very name, the Chechens, was not associated for most Russians with the Chechen War. It was associated with what was reckoned to be the most effectively violent organized crime group across the Russian Federation.
How often are these criminals operating independently, and how often are they part of some kind of a family?
Well, this has been the big change in the way that organized crime is structured. The family structure, a la Sicilian Mafia, Cosa Nostra, and the families here in New York and elsewhere in the United States, came to be understood as inefficient, because if you have a vendetta that is created by family loyalties, you risk losing your men, losing your resources over something which is unnecessary. And you see in The Sopranos, which was a fabulous show in terms of demonstrating how organized crime groups were changing, that Tony Soprano at one point makes the decision to kill his nephew, Christopher Moltisanto, because Moltisanto poses a risk to the organization. Family loyalty was no longer the primary motivator of organized crime. Transaction, money, harvesting of resources became the overriding motivation of organized crime around the world.
My guess is Misha Glennie. He's written a book called McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, and it's published by Knopf, although I think that the title is misleading. I understand why you did it. But in the end, what we're seeing now is small groups and freelancers, but they all understand that they can work together.
That's right.
In some cases, they're practically nations, aren't there? There's one rogue state called Transnistria. Can you tell us about it?
Yes.
Most people probably never even heard
of it. Probably never heard of it. Transnistria emerged in the early 1990s when Moldova announced its independence. And Transnistria, which is in the east, to the east of the Dniester River, a tiny little slither between the rest of Moldova and Ukraine, and populated largely by Slav speakers, Russian and Ukrainian speakers, and not Romanian speakers, which is Moldova. They said they were becoming independent. They were supported by Russia and the Russian army. They had a huge amount of weaponry stockpiled in this little slither of a country. Nobody, not even Russia, recognizes its independence, and it's become a sort of clearinghouse for the movement of illegal goods and services from all over Central Asia and the Balkans heading towards the European Union. And above all, it sells weaponry of one sort or another.
So the whole country is a kind of a criminal operation.
It is a sort of criminal operation, the whole country. And as I say, not recognized by anyone, various members of the European Union have been trying to persuade President Putin to shut it down, as they put it. And he has considered closing down Transnistria at certain points. But with relations between Europe and Russia at a relatively low ebb at the moment, I don't think he's going to. I think he's going to keep sustaining it, which he does through subsidies in its gas supplies and things like that.
Well, is there a reason that we've seen organized crime flourish around the world since the 1980s? Is it simply because of the fall of the Soviet Union?
No. It's a combination of two phenomena. One is the collapse of communism and the huge unregulated space that this opened in the former Soviet Union, Central Europe, Central Asia, I beg your pardon, Eastern Europe and the Balkans, as well as those countries involved in client relationships with the Soviet Union in places like Africa, on the one hand. And on the other hand, just preceding the fall of communism, was the liberalization of financial and commodity markets, i.e. globalization, which led to a very big increase in trade flows, in capital flows, and in migration flows. And this means that things can move about much, much faster and reach places that they've never reached before.
What about the widening gap between rich and poor?
Oh, I think this is terribly important. poverty drives organized crime a great deal. Let me take the example of Albania, for example. Tiny little European country, Europe's poorest country. Communism collapses in 1990 in Albania, and they want to sell one of the few things they can sell, which is oranges and lemons. So they try and sell oranges and lemons into the European Union, which has an agricultural subsidy program called the CAP, which means that it's simply not profitable. The Albanians cannot compete with the Greeks, the Portuguese, the Italians, and the Spanish. So instead of that, they get rid of their citrus fruits and they plant marijuana. And they find that they have a huge market for their marijuana in the European Union. And that is because they're poor, they're discriminated against by European agricultural policies, and so they are driven to producing illicit goods, in this case marijuana, the only thing they can sell.
Another thing that has affected poor people is the sex trade. And you heard some heartbreaking stories along the way in investigating this book.
I was looking at women who were trafficked from Moldova through Russia, through Egypt, and into Israel.
To Tel Aviv. How did Tel Aviv become a major center of the sex trade?
Essentially through globalization, through the liberalization of markets and culture as well. And in the 1990s, the coast of Israel became, you know, a very funky happening place. When the Intifada wasn't up and running, tourism rocketed. You got the introduction of 1 million Russians into Israel. These were essentially, most of them were Russian Jews who were very European in their sensibilities and not so Mediterranean. The Russians brought in a lot of prostitutes. Tel Aviv became a funky place, and along with that, a lot of narcotics were consumed. And the city is to this day riddled with brothels. And the brothels were filled with women who are being trafficked, largely from Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. They are trafficked by a combination of Russians, of Egyptians, of Bedouins, and Israelis. All confessions and all nationalities are complicit in this appalling trade, which leads to women working enslaved in these brothels. They're not servicing clients 20 times a night. They're being raped 20 times a night.
My guest is Misha Glenny, who was the Central Europe correspondent for the BBC World Service for quite a few years in the early 1900s. He's contributed to most major U.S. and European newspapers and current affairs magazines, and he has written a number of books, The Rebirth of History, The Fall of Yugoslavia, also The Balkans, and now Mick Mafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, which is published by Knopf. We will continue after this. We're back with Misha Glenny, whose latest book is called McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, published by Knopf. And as I mentioned earlier, you wrote a couple of books about the Balkans, Yugoslavia and the Balkans. And you dispute the general belief about the wars in Yugoslavia, that they were motivated by ancient ethnic hatreds between Serbs, Croats, Albanians, and Bosnians.
Well, this is really where I started writing the book, because organized crime in the 1990s was part of the furniture in the former Yugoslavia, and you didn't really notice it.
You mean during Tito's years?
No. In the 1990s, after the collapse of communism and when the war started, it was very, very quickly.
Wait, Misha, can we stop for just a second? The message I'm getting here again and again is that whenever a totalitarian state falls, organized crime fills the vacuum.
Pretty much. That's a good message to take. The point is that, you know, we weren't prepared for what was going to happen in Eastern Europe. In fact, most governments didn't think that Eastern Europe was going to fall. Now, fundamentally, it was a fantastic thing. 200 million people were granted their freedom. And I continue to think of it as a year of great celebration, 1989. However, we had no idea what was coming afterwards. And when state authority collapses and when you introduce a new economic system, you're in that period that we now call transition, and it takes a long time to adjust. Now, in Yugoslavia, what I think was going on is that you were seeing the construction of criminal empires by oligarchs and organized crime groups who used the nationalism, whipped up nationalism, as a way of covering what they were actually doing. And the key thing for me was when I came across all the instances of cooperation between Serb and Croat criminal groups, between Serb and Albanian criminal groups, between all the nationalities who, in the daytime, were exhorting their fellow citizens to kill one another, and who at night were literally as thick as thieves, dealing with one another, smuggling cigarettes, smuggling cars, stolen cars, oil, whatever it was.
In Afghanistan, the warlords who were part of the overthrow of the Taliban are now involved in creating a huge narcotics industry. In fact, the Taliban are as well.
Well, the Taliban is back to its best, as it were, horrifyingly, because it is making money hand over fist with the opium trade, and it is now threatening NATO with this rearmament.
Now, how do we fight these things? The U.S. war on drugs is a failure. In Tel Aviv, I would think the Israeli police would be able to crack down on some of these brothels.
Well, funnily enough, Ludmila, whose story I tell, she managed to escape from imprisonment in the brothel where she was in the center of Tel Aviv. And the first thing she did was to go round to the local police station. And the sergeant at the police station was a client of the brothel where she worked, and she was handed back to the brothel owner. And so what you see, along with organized crime, are levels of corruption which basically restrain and make the state incapable of dealing with this issue. Corruption is absolutely critical to the successful functioning of organized crime. Now, as we saw the explosion of organized crime in the 1990s, and with many financial resources available to organized crime, we did not have a concomitant rise in the resources available to law enforcement. And so they've been chasing their tails a lot, trying to keep up with all this sort of stuff.
Now, I would imagine that investigating this story would be rather dangerous. What happens when you go to Odessa and start questioning the underground, or Bulgaria, or you go to Colombia and you try to find out what the FARC is all about?
Well, it's slightly freaky, frankly. I was covering the wars in Yugoslavia, and I was shot at and mortared and artilleried many times. And so In one sense, I had experience of clear and present danger. I didn't enjoy it at all. But I felt, when I was researching this book on organized crime, if I didn't go and talk to these guys, then I would not have an authentic understanding of what their motivations and methods are. What it involved was a lot of preparation beforehand, finding the right interlocutors, intermediaries who would set me up with these guys. They demanded sort of security clearance. You know, I had to tell them what questions I was answering, whether I was working for their opponents and this sort of thing. Each time I went to one of these meetings, I felt slightly uneasy because I didn't know whether I would come out alive or not.
You thought FARC was going to kidnap you.
I thought that if I was going to be kidnapped anywhere, it was going to be in Colombia. And I was greatly relieved when I met the FARC representatives that after playing this musical chairs of going from cafe to cafe, which accompanied almost every meeting I had, they agreed to meet me in a shopping mall. So I felt much safer there because I thought, well, you know, they can't really bundle me into a car here. But also at the same time as being uneasy about all this, this was, as a journalist, you know, this was really exciting, getting to these people to tell their stories.
Talking about shopping malls, what makes Dubai such an important part of the story?
Money, 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 basically.
You call it the largest washing machine in the world.
Absolutely. And that was a quote from a financial manager who didn't want himself identified at all in Dubai. I eventually found somebody, God bless him, who told me the whole story about how it's done. But, you know, Dubai is in a very competitive market with, money being sought by centers all around the world. And Dubai wants to establish itself as the broker of capital between Europe and Singapore, basically. And in order to do it, it has to make it attractive. And when it was beginning to develop this reputation, it didn't care where the money came from.
So the government looks the other way.
It looks the other way. No question.
As it seems to in so many of these stories.
Absolutely. You know, there's an absence of good governance around the world. It's not just in places in Dubai. In some places like South Africa, they don't have the capacity. They're dealing with immense social and political problems on very limited budgets.
My guest is Misha Glenny, G-L-E-N-N-Y. His latest book, McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's talk about Nigeria. Why does it seem to have such an exuberant passion for email frauds?
The email frauds, they started doing it in the 80s when the fax machine, by actually just writing letters, so effectively begging letters. But this developed into what's known as the advance fee fraud, where you say to somebody, look, I've got $10 million, which I want to ship to Switzerland through an account in the West.
Well, first you say, I am the daughter
of
a deposed dictator, and we hid away all this money.
We
so you're immediately
trying somewhere.
To get them complicit in a criminal act.
So you get them complicit in a criminal act, and you get them to forward $5,000 or whatever to help legal fees. Of course, this $10 million doesn't exist. And the key to it is the gullibility and greed of the victims. I mean, I feel sorry for the victims because they often lose the shirt off their back. But, you know, if somebody is offering you $10 million, there's a catch. There must be a catch. Don't fall for it. But the Nigerians, I mean, in one of the stories I investigated, they actually hired a bit of the air ministry, the defense ministry, the air section in Abuja, the capital, so that the victim came to the ministry and actually believed that he was meeting the deputy minister. I mean, they have these fantastically theatrical sort of appetites when they commit their fraud, and they're absolute masters of it.
Are these scammers working for an organization, or are they mostly freelancers?
They're mostly freelancers, and the biggest one of all, which I investigate in the book, where they managed to steal $240 million off a Brazilian bank. I mean, really, the most astonishing fraud I've ever come across.
Wow.
This was a bunch of chances, nothing more.
Well, actually, I once did a show on this, and I think the whole scam started in England or someplace else, but eventually the Nigerians became the experts.
I recently saw at the National Theatre in London a production of Ben Jonson's The alchemist, which is at the turn of the 16th and 17th centuries. And at the heart of the alchemist is an advanced fee fraud. And I almost stood up in the theatre and said, it's the Nigerians.
Let's talk about the Democratic Republic of Congo. Every cell phone and laptop in the world is dependent on a compound called coltan, of which 80% is mined in the eastern part of the DRC, which is where the civil war has been taking place. Millions of people have died. It's the worst catastrophe since World War II.
This is a frightful crime. This is a terrible crime which doesn't get enough attention either in Europe or in the United States. As you say, 4 to 5 million people killed. Now, coltan is no longer almost exclusively mined in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They found a lot in Australia. But
for a long time, it was
the
source.
At the turn of the millennium, 80% of the world's coltan came from the killing fields, not just from the DRC, but from the killing fields of the Democratic Republic of Congo. What was happening is the murderous militias were getting their weapons from Eastern Europe, brokered by Russians, Europeans, Americans, who sold those weapons into the militias and who paid for them with coltan, diamonds, and other minerals. And at some point, the criminal organizations doing those deals were selling the coltan into the licit economy, and the companies buying them were turning a blind eye, effectively.
Did you speak to anybody at Magnavox or Siemens or Nokia?
No, I tried to. I got fax statements from them about this, saying that they recognized the problem and that they were working, which they now are, on the licensing of ethically mined coltan in the way that happened with diamonds. But had it not come from the pressure of non-governmental organizations and indeed the Congress of the United States, I'm pleased to say, then blood diamonds would still exist today, just as blood coltan does.
Sierra Leone, the problem was resolved to some degree, but the blood diamonds still are out there. But one of the big surprises to me was British Columbia, Canada's most westerly province. It's the home to the highest concentration of organized criminal syndicates in the world,
as defined by the United Nations, which is a fairly simple definition of two or more people involved in a conspiracy to commit a crime, because most of the growing of marijuana, I mean, it is a vast industry in British Columbia. It accounts, using Canadian government statistics, for over 5% of BC's, British Columbia's, GDP. And an inspector of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police told me that in the Greater Vancouver area, he estimates that there are 25,000 growing operations, grow ops, alone in residential areas. That's excluding the industrial units and the open air growing.
It's called BC Bud.
It's called BC Bud. It's a vast industry. A lot of it is sent over the border to the United States, where there is a big market. But now, even astonishingly, last year, Quebec overtook BC Bud, or British Columbia, as the biggest producer of marijuana in Canada. This is a huge industry. Law enforcement has no control over it.
They can't just go in there and burn the fields?
They can't. They can't in British Columbia. They can't find them. Big country, and it's done in the interior. I was taken into one of these by a group of, I mean, they looked like loggers, driven for 2 or 3 hours into the interior, right into the forest. And there, in the middle of the forest, were 2 40-foot seagoing containers sunk into the ground with a digger that had dug it up, with an electricity supply that they'd stepped down from the main pylons. And the place was just, you know, heaving with marijuana grown on an industrial scale. Nobody can catch this stuff.
Now we have to talk about China, the world's most populous country, and we keep on hearing about scandals. Are they the result of organized crime?
Yes, and they're also a result of how the country is organized. There's little accountability in China, and that means that on the provincial level in particular, there are compacts between the local party leadership and business that are essentially corrupt compacts. And the deal is, you can make a lot of money, the party says to business, provided you provide jobs, that you create jobs. And in order to do that, they will produce anything.
So does this grow out of the decentralization of Chinese government after Mao died?
Or the constant tension between the center in Beijing and the provinces? Yes. And in order to create those jobs, what they will do is they will produce anything that sells in the West. And as far as they're concerned, counterfeiting Louis Vuitton bags or whatever it is or Mattel toys with leaded paint in them, is legitimate. Now, because our economies have shifted away from manufacturing, which have gone to places like China, and concentrate on services, for us, intellectual property rights, so business like counterfeiting are unacceptable. They're absolutely essential. But for the Chinese, this is bordering on the irrelevant. People want these goods, we will produce them.
Although every once in a while someone is arrested and punished for being corrupt, usually a politician. Is this something that is under the control of a few groups, or is this, again, kind of a freelance?
No, but I mean, you know, on a provincial basis, you see people who are influential and they will have people under them, but it's relatively freelance. And that, I mean, you're right to say that they get arrested now and then, but it's entirely arbitrary. There's no institutional control over who gets arrested and who doesn't. It usually boils down to a dispute with inside the party. And so it's not, you know, I mean, it's not evidence-based systematic law enforcement.
Is Japan the only country where things are a little different? The Japanese Yakuza have complained that their ranks are aging and they're finding it difficult to recruit young members. I guess they're not finding people who want to have tattoos all over their bodies.
No, this is a fantastic interview I did with the deputy head of the Sumiyoshikai, which is the largest Yakuza group in Tokyo and the second largest in the whole country. And it was like talking to stressed senior management when he was saying, you know, we can't recruit the people anymore. They don't understand the values of the Yakuza. They want to go into IT and that sort of thing. And he was concerned about the aging society. And he literally said to me, you know, our problem in the Yakuza, we got too many chiefs and not enough Indians. And you know, he could have been in any industry in any part of the world. And so what they're doing to resolve this problem is they're outsourcing their muscle and their violence to Chinese gangs who are coming in much larger numbers because of the migration possibilities.
We've pretty much run out of time, but I'm going to ask two questions that listeners have sent in. One is, are consumers ultimately to blame for all of this? And the second one is organized crime ever a good thing?
We buy a DVD that's off the back of a lorry, as we say in England. Sorry, if we buy a counterfeit,
the back of the truck, same
back
thing.
Of a truck. If we buy a counterfeit DVD, we're buying into a criminal industry, and we ought to know that. If we put a line of cocaine up our nose, we're buying into a criminal industry. But in some things, like the issue of the cell phones and coltan, for example, on the whole, the consumer is unwitting. You can discover it, but you have to work. And organized
crime, you can't boycott them because all the manufacturers were using them.
No, all the manufacturers were using them. So then you have to campaign. And in terms of, is organized crime ever a good thing? Well, in certain circumstances in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism, they were the only organizations providing jobs and moving things forward. And so you can give them some credence, some credibility for, you know, for trying to modernize and get the country going under capitalism.
Misha Glenny's latest book is called McMafia, A Journey Through the Global Criminal Underworld, published by Knopf. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You're more than welcome.